başına dayan. Tapka aynı bedem moşta dayan. Kad lesat hayyetel hava kebdi. فلا تبي ولا ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Ashi of Ali, it's not good enough for us to know him as a Khalifa only, and just as an Imam in that sense. He is our Wali. He is also our spiritual master. And we have to follow his example. Of course, we cannot become like him. But at least a little bit we should try. And if we try, Allah's help would be there. Yes, we believe in Ali. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through his prophet, has brought the namaz in such a way that you are a Shia or a Sunni or Sufi or a Wahhabi. You don't even do not only mention Ali in namaz, you also mention the entire Ali Muhammad in the salawat of tashahud. All Muslims, from Shia to the Wahhabi, they do the salawat in the tashahud on Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. It's already there. It's already done in a way that even those who oppose the Ahlul Bayt still recite that. And they say it refers to Ali Muhammad, the family of Muhammad only.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Nocturnal colonization. Part 2.
In mid-2008, it was revealed that the U.S. Department of Defense's Research Center had asked a group of researchers to conduct a strange experiment. The strange experiment was not about the range of ballistic cruise missiles or the astonishing speed of the new series of Phantom jets. It wasn't pursuing Ronald Reagan's Star Wars project in the 80s, and it wasn't about the mysterious HAARP project and creating devastating earthquakes in the enemy's lands either. A years-long effort in the U.S. Army to create supermen and superwomen who could automatically reconstruct their body parts hadn't achieved any success. And now, the U.S. Department of Defense's Research Center had put something ordinary on the agenda. The research was about sleep, about setting sleep time and gaining control over it. What the Pentagon wanted to find out was how it could manipulate soldiers' sleep so they wouldn't get tired so soon, they would sleep less, and of course, fight more. In the 18th century, Europeans had already got a penchant for both coffee and colonizing other countries. They took the seeds of the bitter evil fluid with them to other lands. The tropical countries near the equator had fertile plots of land as well as people who could work as slaves on those lands. The lands were supposed to supply the fuel the Europeans, or in other words, European factories needed. Gradually, trading coffee and slaves became interwoven. The slaves were taken from less fertile countries to tropical countries. The high quality that coffee cultivated by them would directly go to modern European coffee houses. Coffee, slaves, and money were the three sides of a triangle. The money side of the triangle would only benefit the colonizing countries. They would somehow colonize the minds and bodies of their own countrymen as well. Trading two black items perched atop the list of lucrative businesses. It might be hard to believe, but today trading coffee is the second most money-making business after oil. The scandals show that although the quality of producing coffee had improved a little, its dark and bleak history was as bitter as it was during the 18th and 19th centuries. Coffee might be more delicious than before. It's presented to the customers in better and more colorful packaging. The companies that produce coffee compete with each other to supply coffee, but the common history of the coffee industry and the laborers on coffee farms doesn't taste any better and doesn't look any better compared to the era of slavery. The history is still as dark as a thick cup of coffee produced by a black slave. This scandal and similar scandals that have been revealed in recent years showed something else as well. Despite the bitter and shocking news, the number of customers in coffee shops hasn't decreased. In fact, coffee in today's world is more vital than we think. The rate of consumption isn't going to fade anytime soon. Today, coffee is an inseparable part of the personal and professional life of workers and employees worldwide. Without coffee, you can't start a day or end it. But the thing is, only 6 hours after you drink a cup of coffee, its effects on your brain will be reduced to half. To improve your body's function, you need to drink another cup of coffee to supply your brain cells with caffeine. In fact, the war between caffeine and the hours of the day is over one thing, sleep. It's obvious that if someone can sleep less, they can work more, and if they work more, the employer will make more money. Coffee is the weapon the capitalist system equips its employees with to send them to the front line in a battle with sleep every day. It's a daily war whose winner is clear from the night before. Owners of capital in the past centuries consider sleep as their most important enemy. They also have other weapons besides coffee in their arsenal to fight with. On December 31st, 1879, Thomas Edison was standing outside his lab in Menlo Park, New Jersey. He was staring at the glamour in the eyes of the journalists in pitch dark at that night. After a while, he raised his head and took a look around and extended his arms towards a lever. After he pushed the lever, hundreds of lights around the lab and the dirt road leading to the lab turned on. All of a sudden, the night in Menlo Park turned into day. What difference does it make who Edison stole the idea of making the lights from? The thing is, the attractive show won the hearts of the capitalists and got Edison closer to his dream of establishing a large light bulb making factory in New York and selling his lights. That night, not many people thought that light could make a tangible effect on the sleep of people in the world. After a few decades, though, as using electricity became commonplace, the concept of night that used to be the best and most appropriate time for sleep was dented. Besides the farms near the equator, the light emanating from Edison's pioneering spectacle was the other side of the capitalist double whammy. It cast a shadow on workers and employees.
You know, having been in the hospital, I understand what that's like. It's just like I've been injected.
Researchers at Oxford University have recently found that people on Earth have been sleeping an hour or two less on average, at least during the past half of a century. It means coffee and light have accomplished their mission. Mass production of toothpaste that release caffeine into the mouth and complementary pills and drinks that are supposed to help facilitate the entry of caffeine into the body more objectively have had a surge in recent years. The interesting point is, as people's sleep has been exposed to greater risks in recent decades, they've come up with new solutions to tackle them. Some people call the solutions the sleep industry. They include a large spectrum of products. The products, which are at times costly, are supposed to give people who are addicted to coffee a better sleep in return for the money they earn. The sleep industry, like the coffee industry, has a whopping financial turnover, about $76 billion annually. The duality in the capitalist system, namely inclination to create sleeplessness and at the same time helping to tackle them, doesn't look strange. Who knows? Maybe the stockholders of companies that produce smart pillows and mattresses for tighter sleep are the very owners of the farms that produce coffee and factories that make light bulbs.
Sleep. We all do it. But why?
Sleep remains one of those remarkable puzzles. We've known the functions of eating, drinking, and reproducing for thousands of years. However, sleep remains a mystery.
Why do some people ruminate all night and other people, they see the pillow, they're gone?
The pattern of sleep among animals, like the birds that can remain awake for 7 days, or a bird like common swift that sleeps only with one side of its brain, and of course, the sleeping habits of dolphins, elephants, toads, and giraffes have attracted the attention of researchers, military institutions, and capitalists. They try to study and mimic the lives of animals and manipulate human beings' sleep. The efforts are not related only to the recent studies by the Pentagon. They date back to the post-World War II years. There's an unverified report from the late 1940s that says a Soviet scientist conducted some secret experiments on human sleep. They wanted to understand the effects of sleeplessness and find a definitive way to stop sleep. They promised 5 political prisoners freedom and locked them up in a sealed room that was filled with a chemical that stimulates sleeplessness. After over a week, some things happened that led to the deaths of 2 of them. The others were afflicted with serious irreparable physical harm, and it caused a conflict between the researchers and the inmates. Although the narrative was never officially confirmed, efforts by the U.S. in the following years confirmed that research on sleep and depriving the soldiers of sleep to improve their function were a reality. Using the LSD psychedelic drug, a £12 billion investment to create biological soldiers, and widespread prescription of stimulant drugs and the magnetic stimulation of the skull are just a few of their numerous efforts to materialize the dream of creating super soldiers who do not sleep. Meanwhile, the media have been largely advertising coffee in recent years along with phenomena like artificial light in order to prove that sleeping less necessarily means more success. This is a frequently quoted myth in success conferences about successful people. To make more money, you have to sleep less. The fact that successful people sleep less is a claim that only capitalists like Edison favor. Edison's business took off the ground after electricity was invented. He'd always say that people should sleep less, about 3 hours a day and not more. He used to say, in fact, that sleep is the inheritance of human beings from cave dwellers. It was obvious why he was saying that. The less people slept, the more they use his light bulbs. Now, nearly a century after Edison's death, some people still favor his words. Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, has recently said in an interview, "Our main rival isn't other online streaming companies, but the number of hours that subscribers sleep." Whether we believe, like Edison, Hastings, and their capitalist buddies, that sleep is a heritage from cave dwellers, or oppose them, the fact cannot be refuted that coffee, or in fact caffeine, has today turned into an essential need of human beings. According to a survey by Food and Chemical Toxicology Journal, 85% of the U.S. population drink at least one caffeinated beverage every day. And even if we don't drink coffee, we shouldn't feel complacent. The bad news is, caffeine isn't found only in coffee. You can find caffeine everywhere. Chewing gums, flavors, toothpaste, tablets, or even energized sunflower seeds, and of course, more importantly, in drinks like Coca-Cola, whose secret and magical caffeinated formula gradually causes addiction.
Is caffeine addiction really a mental illness?
Well, really, technically it is. I'll explain. The DSM-4 lists all mental diagnoses, all psychiatric diagnoses, things ranging from schizophrenia to depression to anxiety. Included in that has always been substance-related issues, whether it's alcoholism or cocaine or heroin abuse or withdrawal. Caffeine is a drug, and when you have those symptoms of withdrawal, it is also included in the classification.
Since caffeine changes the metabolism pattern in our brain, if we want to stop drinking coffee or other caffeinated drinks, our body will start showing negative reactions. Headaches, stomach aches, double vision, anxiety, depression, and similar complications.
If you are really addicted to caffeine and then you suddenly stop, you have to fall into this DSM category. You have to have 3 out of 5 different symptoms. They include things like depression, headache, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, and even some flu-like symptoms, muscle aches and pains.
The process of caffeine withdrawal is exactly like the process of stopping to take any kind of drugs. A researcher studied the effects of caffeine on his own body. At the end of his research, he concluded that caffeine is a soft drug, a soft universal drug.
I actually at one point was up to a pot of coffee a day in medical school. Wow. Really, I had just built up this huge tolerance. I went cold turkey, and this is why I believe in this diagnosis. I was definitely physically and even mentally ill. I felt horrible for a week.
Well, you obviously did well on the exams, though, because you are a
doctor. All that matters. Yes, really. I've got to keep my priorities together here.
In the final days of 1963, two American teenagers decided to work on a project about sleep for their school. They chose the long nights of winter during the new year to break the record of going without sleep and study its effects on themselves. Their study turned the media's heads. A few months after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which had become a front-page story for all newspapers, the 17-year-old Randy Gardner's sleep deprivation experiment had made headlines in America. Soon, a physician affiliated with the Pentagon went to him and monitored his activities. He and one of his friends spoke to Randy. After 11 days and 25 minutes of remaining awake and setting the record, he was transferred to a facilitated U.S. Naval hospital in a special ambulance so they could monitor him and his brain waves. The initial results indicated that after several nights, Randy's sleep had gone back to normal, and surprisingly, he got up and went to school. But later on, the project had some other results that were paid less attention. Randy's brain was taking a napping all that time, and his activities were done habitually and subconsciously. But after a few years, it was revealed that Randy Gardner was suffering from insomnia. Apparently, there was no way to beat sleep without damaging the brain. What was inside the cups on the desks of the U.S. Defense Department researchers finally helped them answer the question, how can we keep the soldiers awake? Like the history of coffee, the answer would help the researchers use other people. The revelation of the results and goals of the research by the Pentagon in fact confirmed Jonathan Crary's claim in his book that sleep is a natural barrier for abusing human beings. A strong barrier against the capitalist nocturnal colonization. The colonization fervently pursued by the Pentagon, Starbucks, Nestle, Netflix, and even factories that produce mattresses and light bulbs.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant practice.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned.
نقل میکند ان جابر سمع امیر المؤمنین رجلا یشتم.
Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari narrated a story about Banbar, the servant of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Once Imam Ali alayhi salam saw that a man was insulting Banbar. He used foul language against him. Imam Ali saw that Banbar was also preparing himself to react against that man. Banbar wanted to answer the bad words of that man with bad words.
فناداه امیر المؤمنین حضرت ندا دادن محلن یا غنبر.
Upon seeing such a scene, Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, O غنبر, come down and leave the man who insulted you with silence, since this is the best punishment for him. Imam continues, if you don't answer the insult by insult, you are making Allah happy and the Satan angry. This sentence of Imam Ali alayhi salam means that the most severe punishment for an insulter is acting patiently and silently with him or her. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashir Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Soul of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Russian defense minister has said Washington is deliberately undermining global stability as it seeks to preserve its power. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Washington is resorting to various forms of coercion as it pushes to create regional alliances aimed against its geopolitical rivals, including Moscow and Beijing, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu has said. He was speaking to his counterparts, representing other members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, at a meeting in New Delhi. The group, which was established by Russia and China, has six other members, including India. Unprecedented pressure is being applied to independent nations through the use of open blackmail, threats, color revolutions, coups, and dissemination of blatant disinformation. All those tools long ago became the Western calling card, the minister said recently. The goal of the U.S. and its allies is to undermine the emerging multipolar world and preserve their dominance, according to Shoigu. Washington chose to dismantle the system of global security in pursuit of its ambition and withdrew from multiple threats with Russia, the minister told his audience. Shoigu said that Moscow had attempted to defuse tensions with NATO through diplomacy in 2021, but its proposals were rejected by the West, proving that it is unwilling to have a partnership of equals with Russia. The minister interpreted the Ukraine conflict as a vivid example of American criminal policy. The U.S. goal in it is to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, create a threat to China, and preserve its hegemonic position, said Shoigu. The Russian official blasted Western supplier weapons to Kiev, stating that they only prolong hostilities and create additional risks to Europe and the entire world. He said the arms make their way to the black market and further into the hands of terrorist organizations. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a Eurasian intergovernmental organization, includes China, India, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Russia, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan among its members. Meanwhile, Press TV reported Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has called on like-minded countries to join forces against the blackmail of Western sanctions during a visit to Venezuela as part of his tour of Latin America. Lavrov said at a joint press conference recently with his Venezuelan counterpart, Ivan Gil, in Caracas, it is necessary to join forces to counter the attempts of blackmail and illegal unilateral pressure of the West. The top Russian diplomat further censured the brutal U.S. sanctions long imposed against the independent Latin American nations such as Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, and pledged full support for Caracas to help its economy become independent from the pressures of the United States and other Western actors. Lavrov and Gil also discussed a number of their bilateral agreements covering financial, energy, agricultural, and other sectors. He also met with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who later said in a post on Twitter that it was a pleasant meeting that strengthened bilateral relations. Lavrov was on a week-long tour of Latin America that began in Brazil. Cuba and Nicaragua have been among the top targets of U.S. economic sanctions and political meddling aimed at destabilizing the two nations that revolted against and ousted U.S.-installed dictators. Lavrov arrived in Brasilia recently, where he discussed issues such as the Ukraine conflict and bilateral trade with Brazilian government officials. He also met with the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and thanked Brazil for its efforts to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. Lula drew criticism from Washington recently for his recent remarks, suggesting the West had been encouraging war in Ukraine by arming Kiev's government. White House spokesperson John Kirby accused Lula of parroting Russian and Chinese propaganda without looking at the facts. Brazil has refused to join Western countries in imposing sanctions against Russia and has turned down their pleas to supply Ukraine with ammunition. During his visit to Brazil, Lavrov further stated that Moscow will support the country's entry into the United Nations Security Council as a permanent member.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about three types of blood discharge. Well, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching maqasid, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And so with our guest speaker, as promised, we are going to talk about the different kinds of blood discharge experienced by women. But this one in particular, we're going to talk about nifas. Sheikh Javid, you know, you delineated and described different kinds of blood discharge experienced by the ladies in the previous episodes. You talked about the different types of istihada, for example, and you differentiated from the hayz, right, and the menstruation. And now let's turn to the other type of blood discharge, which is somehow called the postnatal blood, right?
Yes.
Would you tell our audience a little bit more about this kind of blood discharge?
Well, the postnatal blood is a kind of blood experienced by ladies or women who give birth to a child.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the blood is discharged as soon as the birth, comes out and appears. The blood which comes before the birth of the child is not considered to be postnatal blood. It's not considered to be nifas.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes the ladies do discharge blood, sometimes because of some rupture that takes place, or tearing might happen, something. The child is still there in the woman's uterus or womb. And then this is not called nifas, but as soon as the child appears, then the blood which is discharged is called nifas. So again, there is another issue when it comes to the period of nifas. Of course, the period of nifas is like it can be minimum 1 hour, 2 hours, 1 day, or 2 days. And the maximum period of nifas is 10 days. Now,
So from 1 day to 10 days?
Yeah, for 1 day, 1 hour to 10 days. Because maybe if a woman experiences miscarriage, okay?
Right.
And that there is fetus, and the fetus or the embryo comes out, and there is no other blood left. So she washes herself, and there is nothing else coming, okay? So it might take 1 hour. And it might take 2 hours, and the maximum is days in which a woman can be in her nifas is 10 days, mm-hmm. Okay? So there's one thing we should understand, that according to Ahle Sunnah,
right,
the maximum days of nifas is 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
And even more than that, depending on whether you are a Maliki or a Hanafi or a Shafi, okay?
I see.
So unfortunately, the Shia ladies who associate with Ahl-Sunnah and who live in a predominant Sunni community,
mm-hmm.
They receive much of their information from the ladies around them.
I see.
And they happen to be Sunnis, and they are living in the Sunni environment. So they are under the impression that a woman in Nifas, in the state of Nifas, must stay, you know, away from prayer and fasting and other obligatory duties for as many as 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I know. I'm sure about it. So many people who send emails, ask questions, they think that I'm in my 30th day. I have given birth to a child. What should I do? Should I perform ghusl? Should I do prayer? And they are still, you know, observing the fast. That's not good. You know.
What about the Shia women?
Because of a lack of information. We have not been able to communicate the message of religion to them. So they have remained ignorant, and acting according to Sunnah method of nifas.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Sovit, what about the Shia women? You said from 1 hour to 10 days. Maximum period or the minimum period of, in fact, being in the state of nifas. But those women who are experiencing nifas, this type of blood discharge, are they allowed to actually perform the various acts of worship, such as the prayer, you said?
Never, never.
They can't.
It's not permissible to pray, to fast, to enter mosques, you know, to stay in the mosque, to leave anything in the mosque. I know that that three types of blood, like we say, excessive blood, you know, hayz, nifas, these types of blood are very filthy. Imagine if you have, let's say I give you an example. If you have if your nose is bleeding, mm-hmm. and a drop of blood falls on your dress,
right,
and the size of the blood is not bigger than the size of your thumb or the size of a dirham, you can pray with it. You can pray with it,
right?
But you can never pray with the blood, of menses, with the blood of nifas. Mm-hmm. If a drop of the nifas blood falls into a well, all of the water must be drawn out and taken out to make it pure.
Right.
And that's the difference between nifas blood, the blood of hayz, and the ordinary blood that comes from a wound or injury. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it shows that the blood of menses is very impure.
I see.
And of course, a woman in her nifas cannot... cannot recite those verses which contain, or those chapters of the Quran which include obligatory sajda. She cannot touch the script of the Holy Quran.
But can they read the Holy Quran without those?
Yeah, without those chapters, without those surahs, of course.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Sovit, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the different kinds of blood discharge, especially nifas, the postnatal blood. My emphasis on this terminology, postnatal blood.
Yes.
Sheikh Sovit, you know, why do we call it postnatal? What about that kind of blood or any other kind of discharge from the womb of a lady just prior to the delivery?
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider that also part of the nifas, or it's something else?
It's not considered to be nifas because we use the term postnatal because we understand that the blood which comes after the birth, the childbirth, is considered to be nifas, not any kind of blood that comes before it.
Yes.
Because there might be injuries, there might be other problems and complications which a woman might suffer from, and that blood should not be treated as the blood of nifas. And therefore, the rules applicable to that blood are different.
I see. But let me ask you this question also before we end this episode. If a woman misses her prayers or fasts or any kind of acts of worship during haiz or nifas, does she have to repeat them all later?
Of course, we know that when it comes to haiz, the rules which are applicable to a woman in the state of menses are the same as the rules which are applicable to a woman in the state of nifas. They are the same. And so a woman in her menses cannot pray, she cannot fast. And the same is the case with a woman in her nifas.
Right.
She cannot pray, she cannot fast, she cannot enter, for example, the mosques, okay?
Yes.
There are two mosques, okay? One is Masjid al-Haram and then Masjid al-Nabi, which a woman in her in the state of impurity can never enter. Even if she enters from one gate and walks out of another gate, that's absolutely forbidden. But when it comes to the local mosque, like the mosques we have in our neighborhood, okay,
yes.
If a woman enters from one gate and quickly gets out, walks out of another door, that's permissible. That's okay. So when it comes to prayers and fasting, of course, the prayers are forfeited. They are, you know, she is not supposed to make up those prayers. And, of course, it's not even recommended for her to, because this is the dictate of the Sharia. This is what the Sharia has stated.
I see.
That a woman in her menses, in her period, is exempted from praying.
I see.
But when it comes to fasting, of course, she must make up the fast whenever she can. She must not delay it until the next Ramadan. In the event that she delays, of course, she must give a penalty also. The penalty is 750 grams of foodstuff for delaying it.
I see.
And that penalty, that food must be given to the poor and to the needy Shia Muslims.
Thank you very much,
Thank you.
For your nice comments and answers to the questions that are raised in this program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program and tuning in to the IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for that. And we leave you on Allah care. So please keep us in your duas too. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem La ilaha illa hu Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir La ilaha illa hu وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.